Hola.
It's Carmen Wong Ulrich here, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 6th, 2013. So this show is about you and the choices you make and how to get not only more money out of these decisions, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, financial resolutions, big and small.
My name is Jeff, and I am a physician. In the past, I've made resolutions to pay off all my credit cards. I've made resolutions to add principal payments to my mortgage payment, and made resolutions to save money for the future and for kids' education. The things that distract me the most from getting my resolutions done would be mostly time and resources and the ability to do it. One time I carried a credit card debt for quite a long time and made minimum payments and made a resolution to pay it off, and over a period of a year made that commitment and paid it off. And it really changed our household budget. We decided just to bite the bullet one day and do it. We knew we had to do it. You know, the resolutions never seem to occur as quickly as you'd like them to, but resolutions are important. Realize that it might take time, but if you make the commitment, things can be done over time.
So those resolutions are important, but is it always about willpower when it comes to success? Listen, I don't want you to beat yourself up about it this year, because you may have been missing one key element to getting your resolutions right. Time. So to start the show, we've invited Maria Konnikova. Maria is a psychologist and author of Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Maria, welcome to Marketplace Money.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Maria, every year, everybody makes these resolutions, right? This year's gonna be different. In terms of self-control, how does that play a big part in financial resolutions in particular?
One of the things that we're really, really bad at is figuring out the future. What will I be like? What will I want? So the future tends to be very cool. It's distant. It's hard to visualize. It's hard to see it concretely. But the present is very hot. It's immediate. You can feel it. You can taste it. You're living it.
Right.
Exactly. And so it's really hard to pass up those immediate wants in favor of some cool future thing that may or may not even happen. So you may have the best resolutions in the world, and then in the moment when you're confronted by that hot stimulus, the resolutions fall away because all of a sudden you have it right in front of you. So you need to think, what can I do to make it easier for me? And some of the newest research is showing that it might have to do with our perception of time. How we see the future versus the present. And the theory is that the future is inherently uncertain.
Right.
So something might happen, something might not happen. And we're pretty bad at setting time horizons. If you say as a New Year's resolution, I am going to lose weight and I'm going to lose a pound a week,
right,
where in the world is that coming from? And then when you don't lose a pound a week, you get very frustrated and you start eating. You're saying, well, this diet isn't working. I'm going to throw it out. So what this research is saying is that you need to do a lot of legwork from the beginning so that you can set realistic time goals, so that that uncertain time becomes more concrete, so that you can know exactly when certain things will happen. And that way, you won't get as discouraged along the way.
So there's a big part of it is building those time frames. And, you know, in teaching behavioral economics, I talk a lot about the idea of willpower and the psychic cost. So it takes effort to think about this. And when it comes to financial goals, that psychic cost, what role does it play and how do we make it cost less?
I think it plays a role in your immediate needs, in the sense that it's not like weight where you're losing weight or not losing weight, but it's much more, well, I need this money now. And if I don't see it, if I don't think that the money is coming in when I think it will, for instance, if I've invested it in the stock market and I expect it to have, I don't know, a 5% return or whatever it is, 2%, 20%, I set some goal for myself and that's not happening. And then I start saying, well, I could be using the money right now and spending it on all of these things and I'm not allowed to because it's sitting here and the stock is down. It's not even up. And you keep checking, you keep looking at what's going on with the stock market, you get frustrated, you pull your money out. You know that we often tend to sell at low points when we should
Exactly.
When we should really be holding on to stocks, we sell them because we get discouraged and we say, oh, look, it's going down, down, down. Whereas really we should be selling when they're going up, up, up. But it's hard to do that because then we're saying, oh, look, my return is even better than I thought it was. So going back to that setting realistic goals, you need to realize that whatever it is you're investing in, whether it's a stock market, whether it's a fund, whether you're, you know, just putting it in a bank account and expecting something to happen, there is going to be uncertainty, and you need to incorporate that initially into your thinking about it so that you, in a way, tie your hands.
And to that point about helping someone tie your hands, figuratively, of course, can peer pressure play a good role here?
Absolutely. One of the things that can keep us best on the straight and narrow when it comes to our resolutions is knowing that people are watching. There are some really effective websites right now that help self-control by having you publicly commit to a certain goal. So you say, I am going to save X number of dollars, I'm going to lose X amount of weight, and you make this pledge publicly. And so then if you fail,
You're accountable. So this is, social media can help you in this,
exactly,
in this vein.
Accountability is incredibly important.
And Marie, I cannot let you go without asking you about how to think like Sherlock Holmes. How would he have a New Year's financial resolution? And how would that work quickly?
Sherlock Holmes is really an expert at separating emotion and logic. Emotion is one of the things that prevents us from being able to keep New Year's financial resolutions, or really any financial resolutions, whenever we set them, because, as we mentioned, it's hot, the immediate stimulus
is
incredibly hot. You feel it. So what Sherlock Holmes does is he acknowledges those hot emotions, but then he separates himself from them. He says, I'm not going to let that affect my judgment. And he has a very rational, kind of much more removed way of approaching it. He'd say, okay, well, here is what we know. I'm going to take the time to think it all through ahead of time. And then when those emotions come up, I'm not going to act on them.
Right. And you're going to put those things into place in terms of a time frame and an amount, and you're just going to stick to it because it's all about being rational. Maria, thank you so much for joining us. Maria Konnikova is a psychologist and the author of Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
And we want to help you get a fresh start in 2014. So if you have a money resolution that you want to make and you can use a little bit of a helping hand, make sure you write us at marketplacemoney.org and click on that Ask Carmen button. You know, managing your money, it's a lot like dieting. Don't eat too much. Don't spend too much. Both take a lot of willpower and a lot of planning. So back in October, we spoke to Rob. He's an attorney from Connecticut. We talked to him about his weight loss goals. Rob put his money where his mouth is, and he decided to pay or punish himself to lose that weight. Rob's deadline just passed, and we're checking in to see how he's done. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Carmen. Thanks. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. So tell us a little bit about what your goals were for weight loss, particularly the fact that we just passed your deadline of November 27th.
Yep, we did. My goal was to lose approximately a little over 30 pounds by November 27th. I was ultimately able to do it, which was great. So I made it a little bit under in time, and so I was able to get my money back, which was great.
So explain a little bit about how you rewarded and punished yourself in terms of if you didn't meet goals.
And it kind of had a couple of different aspects to it. One was that every week I would weigh in, and then if I wasn't at my lowest weight of the process, then I would have to pay in $10, and that money was held in a fund that a friend of mine held for me. And then in addition to that, there were, if I didn't comply with my diet requirements and things, I also kind of incurred other penalties. By the end, there was about a little over $400 that my friend was holding, and then about another $300 that if I hadn't made it by the deadline, I would have had to pay out. And because of the way kind of our household finances work, I basically kind of get an allowance. That's my fund money. And so I would have been basically bankrupt for a while.
It wasn't just the money. It was kind of the social pressure, right? Because you built a Facebook group. So you had people to report to. It's almost as if you treated this like a job.
This was kind of the latest evolution of a variety of different things I've tried over the years. And ultimately, I realized that it was best to have people kind of watching and rooting on to be accountable if I didn't make it. It was nice. Everybody's very supportive. It was getting pretty tight towards the end, so it was nice to have people kind of rooting me on.
So the combination of the two things, Rob, the combination of money as a reward or a punishment, plus the community of people there, what do you think in terms of which was the bigger motivator, or did you need those two things together in order for this to work?
I needed both, and I think that the money was critical because it kind of crystallized things and set a specific deadline and also like a fairly severe consequence if I didn't make it. As I was getting towards the end and I was realizing I was going to have to really focus, I promised my wife that I would not eat anything I wasn't supposed to eat for the remainder of the time. And that was kind of the one time throughout the process where I, you know, wouldn't even sneak a bite of anything. I wouldn't, it's just one cookie. It's not going to hurt. The money motivated me to make the promise. And then the promise was what kind of ultimately kept me being completely strict and completely compliant.
Now, you know, when it comes to weight loss, maintenance tends to be a problem. So what do you think you're going to do, you know, in terms of maintenance?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. And in fact, because my diet ended right before Thanksgiving, I went crazy. I proposed a maintenance agreement with my friend. And so that one, I have a certain set weight for every month. If I go over that weight, then I have 3 weeks to get back under. And if I can't do that, then I have to pay $100 immediately to charity. So this time I won't have the opportunity of getting it back.
Thank you so much, Rob. And listen, the folks out there can take a lot of inspiration from this. Customize a program, whether it's saving money, losing weight, that really just best works for you. Rob, do you mind if we check in on you about, you know, several months out and see how you're doing?
Yeah, I'll say okay for now. Yeah, we'll see.
Coming up, it doesn't take us much time to get to the bottom of one listener's budget.
We're going to find you $1,000 a month, like in 2 seconds, basically. There's two things to consider here. One is, how much life insurance do you really need?
How much is too much? Instant savings by simply switching products. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. So between holiday spending and New Year's resolutions, a lot of us are really geared up to cut where we can and start 2014 fresh and flush. And with that in mind...
Carmen, what's going on?
Tis that time to answer some of your money questions. And joining me today is Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and a former colleague of mine. Welcome, Jill.
Great to be with you.
So, Jill, we have on the line Martin. Martin is 31. His wife is in her late 20s. And they have a very interesting conundrum because Martin did what a lot of folks do, which is say, you know what, rent and renting, that's just not good for my money. So we need to buy. But then the trouble is that Martin found out that owning is a very expensive commitment indeed. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Martin, talk a little bit about this switch that you made from being a renter to an owner.
Well, about this time last year, my wife and I decided that we would like to buy a home because we've been paying $1,800-ish for renting, and we thought that maybe we should pay down to buy a house. And luckily, we have our family to help us with the down payment, and we were able to find a place that fits within our budget. However, after we purchased the house, we found out that although the mortgage is $1,500, there are other extra cost that comes with owning a home, such as the monthly escrow fee that we pay toward our property tax.
I bet that was a big surprise, Martin.
Oh, yeah. That quickly grew at least almost doubled the cost that we have to pay for our home.
Wow. Hi, Martin. This is Jill. What is the homeowners association fee, just out of curiosity?
We have two because we're a part of a huge community. So it's about $300.
Jill, we see this a lot, though, in terms of really calculating and saying, I need to be a homeowner because right now I could afford this much of a mortgage. But that's just tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And even when you say the mortgage, the property tax, I think the big category that people really omit and or at least gloss over is the maintenance. And, you know, you think, I'm buying a brand new house, condo, whatever it is. I'm just telling you, every year something happens. Every time you turn around, you will need a extra $1,000 because of the washing machine breaking or the hot water heater.
Right? I was going to say that's the worst one,
right?
Hot water heater.
Classic. And so, but you know, here you are, Martin, you're in it. Where do you stand now? So you're working and does your wife work as well?
So we're both attorneys. However, we're not hired as a permanent. We both are working on projects. Luckily for me, I've been on the same project for 2 years. So my income is relatively stable.
How much do you make?
I make about $6,000 a month, but for my wife, her project comes and goes, and now she's trying to start her own business, clothing design business. I think that will also increase our spending a little bit more, hopefully not that much. My question now is, how do we cut down on the day-to-day spending so we can not to be too...
too behind on everything.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, Martin, because you're a contract, and the thing about working under contracts, which has its pluses and minuses, its pluses is that there's no real cap on how much you can earn. It's not like you're tied to a salary, so you can earn a lot. However, it's unpredictable income. So even somebody who is a contract employee absolutely needs to have more cash on hand, especially if you're a homeowner. And it's really preferable to buy actually less home than you can afford to protect yourself in case there's a downturn. So, Martin, in terms of that mortgage, you say you want to look at your budget. Do you think, though, with your wife starting this new business and you possibly 2 years down the road not knowing for sure that you're going to have another contract, are you considering, are you saying we are staying in this home and we're going to figure out how to make it work? Or would you think about maybe we need to just go smaller on the home and it's just too much money right now?
I think at the moment we are trying to stay in this home. And right now we're able to because of my parents' help, our parents' help. We don't want to depend on them every single time that we need help. We are now kind of like adults now, even though not to them.
Kind of? Sort of?
But so we don't want to be like any high schooler or even college student where, hey, mom and dad, I need money right now. Can you, you know, give me $1,000 or $2,000 just so I can get by? But we don't want it to be that way. So right now, I think we're okay. So in the beginning, if my wife also have projects, all her earning goes into our savings.
That's fantastic. But yeah. even still, though, you're falling behind and getting help. And I want to bring Jill on this one here, Martin.
Okay.
Can you explain to us, because we come across, Jill, these crazy products every once in a while. On the budget that you gave to us, life insurance / IRA, $1,200 a month. What is that?
My parents bought me a life insurance when I was, I think, high school, when my parents and my parents are still working in the U.S. So after I got married, I thought maybe I should need life insurance to protect myself and my wife just in case any accident happens because, you know, either of us have a really huge assets to help us from that. Initially, we had each of us have one universal life and one term. The sales representative said, hey, we have this good deal. Why don't you up your, you know, term life and turn into universal and you can keep whatever amount and you'll be a lower if you just buy universal mm-hmm. again.
Martin, beware of anybody coming to you saying, I got a good deal for you. Jill, what is it? What should he do with this? This is a lot of money every month.
Oh, yeah. We're going to find you $1,000 a month, like in 2 seconds, basically. You know, look, there's two things to consider here. One is, how much life insurance do you really need? Let's start there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're both young. You can run through these calculations in about 5 seconds. Go type in life insurance calculator online, and you will get a lot of different choices. And it'll say, what's your mortgage, blah, 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 and you'll come up with a number. And I'm going to give you a round number. You know, let's say that right now you don't have kids, right?
No.
So you're just for each other. So maybe you need $500,000 or $1 million of term life insurance each. That's it. You're young, you're healthy. This is going to cost you less than $500 a year. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get to buy. You buy that and you cover your life insurance needs. You buy life insurance. Term life insurance will cover about 98% of the people out there who need life insurance. About 98% will need term. There are 2% who will need that other more expensive kind of insurance, but you're not in that group. I promise you that. Now you're going to free up all this money because you're not going to put money into a big, fat, universal life insurance policy. So the first thing, as Carmen said, is that you need to beef up your emergency reserve fund. You got to have a year of expenses in the bank. That's that. That's what you need to do.
And no help from the parents then.
And
then you won't need the help.
Exactly. We've gotten your parents out of this. And maybe, just maybe, you can afford to stay in this place. I'm not convinced yet, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sort of thinking that if you had equity in this place and you could get out and you could give your parents the down payment back and you really do want to be independent, then you actually can start for the level playing field. But if you want to stay in it, that's a very easy way to identify a chunk of money. And for your regular old retirement investing, each of you having an IRA or a Roth IRA, you know, probably a Roth for you guys because you're so young, you do it really simply. You go to Vanguard, you go to T. Rowe Price, you go to Fidelity, you open up an account, you have them suck a certain amount of month out of your checking account. That's how you're going to start saving for retirement. But essentially, freeing that chunk of money up should really help give you some flexibility here. You really have to make a decision about this. If you're convinced that you got to stay in this place, that's one way to do it. Then you've just got to go through the way you spend your money with a fine-tooth comb. There's no easy way to do it. It's like saying to somebody, how do I lose weight? Well, you know what? You stop eating and you exercise.
You cut back.
Yeah.
Well, and Martin, the thing is, being a contract employee, it's very risky to buy more home than you really can comfortably afford. If you want to keep the home, just know that things are going to be tight for a while and you're going to have to pay attention to where the money goes. But to Jill's point about this life insurance, there's no need for you to be putting $1,000 into this policy. You absolutely can cut back there. The other costs of the home that you could possibly go at with in terms of that fine-tooth comb are those utilities. You're spending $600 a month on water, electricity, trash, cable, phone, all that stuff. And though that seems actually pretty much average for people in certain areas, you can also cut that down as well. So it's more of paying attention to where the cash goes on a monthly basis. Get rid of that policy, putting money into that policy, and you guys can be basically independent and on your own very quickly. What do you think?
I think that's a good idea, but a follow-up is that what is a good budget to spend on, say, utilities and those kind of stuff?
There is no magic number. I wish, Jill, don't we wish we had this magic number and a magic wand and we could just go bing? It really is and depends on you. Now, there are guidelines that you should follow. It is dangerous to have your housing costs, all of those costs that you have there, right now are at about half of your take home.
Yes.
That's dangerous territory.
Yeah, it should be about a third.
Yeah, because you think about it as your budget, your income is like a pie. And everything gets a slice, right? Well, if half of the pie is gone and the only thing you've paid for is the roof over your head, recipe for disaster.
All right, let's not say disaster. That sounds very dramatic.
It is. I'm being dramatic because if you think about it, and it's a good question to ask simply because, Martin, when your housing takes up 50%, there is no breathing room for anything else. So that is something to really think about. And the reason why I say disaster is because, frankly, I'm one of those people that always says, what if? What if your wife's new business doesn't take off? What if you end up having a baby? So if you think about all those what ifs, half of your budget going to your housing seems pretty scary. And Martin, Jill just saved you $1,000 a month.
So go get that money. Don't cancel the policy before you actually get underwritten for your term policy. Don't cancel the old universal life before you get your new term life.
I understand.
All right. Thanks, Martin, so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jill, stay with us, though. We're going to be back with another caller right after this. My guest this hour is CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, and we're taking your calls, so let's get back to that phone. Suzanne joins us from Boston. She's a longtime listener. We love longtime listeners. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi there.
Now, Suzanne, you have a very interesting question because you are a resident with your husband in a hospital. Now, you make pretty good money, but you're still in that resident phase, so it's not up there in the six figures. And you have a lot of student loan debt.
Yes.
Tell us about that debt.
I finished medical school 3 years ago with approximately $200,000 of medical student loan debt. Prior to graduation, my school had a financial aid session where an outside company came in to speak with us. And this company encouraged us to take advantage of both public service loan forgiveness and income-based repayments. So my basic understanding of the public service loan forgiveness program is that borrowers can qualify for forgiveness of the remaining balance of their direct loans after they've paid 125 qualifying payments on those loans while fully employed at certain public service employer jobs. And the company at the time was saying that working in the nonprofit hospital setting as a resident or a physician counts towards those payments. So after hearing that, my husband and I decided to take advantage of the program. And right now, we're making the minimum monthly payment toward my student loans, which is approximately $450 a month. But this doesn't even cover the interest. So the total amount of my loan has grown to now $220,000, $100,000. When I make more money, my IBR payments will go up, and then my debt will stop increasing. And our hope is at the end of this 10-year period, the outstanding balance will be forgiven. But I'm getting a little nervous about it. So my questions really are, can I rely on this public service loan forgiveness program to forgive all of this money at the end of 10 years? If I have more money to put down towards these loans, should I do this?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you both work in a public hospital or public setting?
No, just I do.
And this debt is all yours?
Yes.
Jill, this program does exist. It's not like it's in fairy tale land.
No,
but
no, it's true. But you do have to keep working for this qualifying employer, right? And so I looked it up because you know what? Who knows these things off the top of my head? There's a fabulous website, by the way, for everyone who is listening, studentaid.ed.gov. It's a really an awesome site. But, you know, when you go there and you look at it, it says qualifying employment is any employment with a federal, state, or local government agency, entity, organization, or non-for-profit organization that's been designated as an IRS under basically a 501c3, which is pretty much every hospital that's out there. Many, you know, even some semi-private hospitals are 501c3s. So can I ask you a very personal question? It's just between us and everyone else listening. Which hospital do you work at in Boston?
I work at a small community hospital in Boston.
Okay, that's fine.
Even better.
But that's, yeah, because that's going to be a qualifying institution, right? And
right.
So the reality is if you see yourself continuing to work, you're going to have your residency and then maybe you're going to be an attending physician at you're in an area where there's tons of hospitals, then it should work.
It's very, very smart. Now, all the loans, Suzanne, all these loans are federal, yes?
Yes.
So you planned well,
yeah,
my dear. You planned really well because that is the fact that these loans actually are out there in these loan programs. But what I would recommend is this, because in the past, I've had folks who thought they qualified and for whatever the reason was, however they were paid, maybe they didn't, or it was only a partial qualification. So Suzanne, what you need to do is you need to head to the administrative offices of the hospital you're at and talk to them about what you need in terms of paperwork and qualifying information to make sure that you absolutely qualify for this program. Because, my God, $220,000.
It's pretty awesome. Hey, I have another personal question. What's husband's specialty?
He works in technology.
All right. So you're going to wipe this debt out. You're going to have some money to spend. You're going to like create a life together. I mean, if you were burdened by this debt, obviously so many of your choices would be changing, right? I mean, you may not even, I don't know what your specialty is, but, you know, you may say, well, gosh, I guess dermatology does sound good after all because I've got 200 grand.
I'm not taking insurance anymore,
yeah,
people.
But I mean, it's really true that you realize that when you assume this kind of debt, your future choices are curtailed. And so by being able to wipe this out, you probably are going to do exactly what you want to do. And that's pretty awesome.
Thank you. Can I ask you one follow-up question to that?
Sure.
Which is, if we could put some more money down towards this debt, does it make sense to at least pay off enough so that it's not growing in terms of interest, because that's what makes me really anxious.
Because you're going into the whole moral hazard territory. How much do you feel like you should pay? I believe that the program exists for a reason. You are performing a service by working in a community hospital. Therefore, the reward for performing that service is, first of all, your pay is lower, but you will be able to have this loan forgiven. So I see absolutely no reason to put more money towards that loan. You already get paid less than someone who works at a big hospital. So basically, your income is cut from it, and the reward that you get is you get this loan forgiven at the end.
Yeah, it's not like you're gaming the system. You're not, you know, borrowing a bunch of money and then going bankrupt. It is a program
Suzanne's
that exists.
Suzanne's feeling guilty right now, Jill. She's feeling very guilty.
So you know what you can do to feel less guilty is you can keep doing your job. You can put away your money. You can put money into your 403B. Get yourself on your feet so that, you know, the world doesn't have to ever have to take care of you. How's that?
Okay. That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Suzanne.
Hi.
And thank you so much, Jill Schlesinger, for joining us today from CBS News.
Great to be with you.
So what do you want help with this coming year? Let us know. I want to hear from you. Go to marketplace.org and click on Ask Carmen. Next, how about finding stock in your stocking?
His girlfriend recently set up a brokerage account, and he wants to give her 100 shares of a stock they both invest in as a gift. Stock's worth around $2,000. What's the tax situation here?
Well, the answer to that and many, many more, giving money as a gift. Our holiday edition of Lightning Round, coming up next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. You know, we get way more questions than we can possibly answer at once. However, this is why we created the Lightning Round. 5 minutes of straight personal finance. What you need to know right now. We've got all your questions on the holidays, stocks, bonds, IRAs. This week, we are joined by Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
How's it going?
Good. Now, you are here to keep me to time and keep me honest.
Yes, and you have 5 minutes to answer 5 questions. Are you ready?
Ready.
Go! Our first question comes from Gene. He sent us an email on something that might be on the minds of holiday shoppers. His girlfriend recently set up a brokerage account, and he wants to give her 100 shares of a stock they both invest in as a gift. Stock's worth around $2,000. What's the tax situation here?
Ah, here's the thing. $2,000. Wow, Gene. Look at you.
Yeah,
first
generous.
Of all, I diversify and not just have one stock. Beyond that, there are some tax implications on financial gifts, right?
Uh-huh.
But the max for 2013 is actually $14,000 before you have to report it to the tax man. So that's your exclusion. So $2,000, you're right under there. And if you need more information on 2014 and forward, make sure you go to irs.gov.
Wow, nicely done. Okay, we have 2 questions. They're kind of related, both from Facebook. Erin's got a new baby. She wants to know what's the best type of account or best way to set up so family members can contribute to it, especially for college, like a college account for the kid.
That would be a 529, folks.
529.
Those 529s, consider those the IRAs for college education. And not only can multiple family members put money in there or other people, but should that child not use the money, if there's a sibling, the sibling gets to use the money.
Oh, that's
good place
nice.
To go. Go to savingforcollege.com for free info.
Also, Aries wants to know what's the best way to give a college fund to her brother's kids?
Well, open a 529. Family members can open 529s for other folks. So that is awesome. And if you start it, you could even ask the rest of the family every year that instead of buying, you know, more plastic stuff, that they could actually put more money in that account.
But I love plastic stuff.
I cannot stand, no more, please. No more plastic stuff, please. But you want to make sure that if they already have a college fund, that you talk to them about it and see what form it is. If they don't have a 529 and you don't want to open one either, just send them a check and say, please put this into the college account.
Okay, so no coffee cans.
No coffee cans.
Okay, fair enough.
Not for college.
Also on the Facebook, Jennifer's got a question. Her son wants to get to know investing, but he's 11. Kid wants to get started early.
Mm-hmm.
She's thought about giving him a penny trading account with $100 in it, but she doesn't know if that would really help him learn. Getting him one or two shares of a stock he likes would work, but what if it tanks? What's the best holiday gift to help a youngin' learn something Maude Dukes doesn't necessarily already know how to do herself?
Well, one thing you're certainly teaching him is how to lose money.
Oh, a valuable lesson.
But bump. That's the thing with penny stocks. Here's what's even better. You don't have to have money invested to learn about how to invest. What you want to do is make sure he just has the basics. And I'd actually prefer, stocks, you want to get there. I knew all about those at like 8. But you want to make sure, I know, totally. But you want to make sure, I'm a total nerd, that you also have him understand cash, credit, banking accounts, all of that stuff as well. If you want to fiddle around and you want to play around the market, but you don't want to risk real money, and $100 to him is real money, MarketWatch from Wall Street Journal has a virtual stock exchange. And I've been playing with that thing for years. Some years I do good, some years I do not, because it's play money. It's not real money.
Ah.
But you can go in and actually pretend to invest in the market.
Is it fun?
I find it a lot of fun.
Mary wants to know. She asks us, can you gift someone a retirement account?
I'm wondering if she means when and if you pass away. That's what I'm wondering. Because you can't, when somebody is alive, you can't necessarily gift them.
Right.
But even if you could, there's a ton of tax implications. Not only the gift tax, but what if that person is not yet in retirement and wants to cash the account out? What if you need to cash the account out first? And then give it to them. If this is someone who's passed away, yes, you can. And a lot of parents do that. But just know this, that you can't get to it until 59 and a half without penalties and fees.
Okay. What kind of penalties?
A lot of penalties, Ben. Let me tell you, your penalties and fees for an early withdrawal without a hardship waiver will probably be about 40%, 50% of taxes and penalties and fees. Add them all up.
Okay. Time's up. Carmen, you answered 5 questions. Well done.
All righty then. Thank you so much. Listen, you can find all these answers and resources to the questions that were just answered at marketplacemoney.org. You can also submit your questions right there. Look for the button that says Ask Carmen. Click on that button or right below it, record your question, and I'll answer it with your voicemail. Thank you, Ben, so much.
Later, Carmen.
You know what? You are never too young, well, maybe almost never, to start developing some smart money habits.
My name is Taylor, and I'm 11 years old. One of my financial resolutions would be saving up my money for a new bedroom. I want like a new bedspread and maybe some new lamps and a carpet and all that kind of stuff. I've saved up for like my phone. My mom and dad let me get a phone for my 5th grade graduation, so I kind of saved up and said, I'll save up and I'll get a phone. It was actually kind of hard because, you know, you have to be careful with your money and you can't, like, buy, like, anything you want. Like let's say you want, like, a little toy at the store, but you can't get it because you know you're trying to save up. So it's like you're trying to stay neutral. So yay.
All right, Taylor, good on you, and good on your mom and dad for talking money early and giving you some really good savings habits. You know, for many of us, our parents and our family, these were the first folks to teach us about money and give us lessons, good and bad. Now, if you head online, we have some fantastic family money stories from people that you may know. For example, one of my favorite authors, Amy Tan, and Bad Religion's lead singer, Greg Graffin, a professor, and more. So you can find a collection of these stories at marketplacemoney.org. like snowflakes and fingerprints, each of us has our own money style and financial personality. And sometimes, clashing money personalities can really sabotage your goals.
I have a question.
My question is...
We're going back to the phones. Dean joins us from Clayton, North Carolina. He has a story that may sound a little familiar to you, especially those of you who are part of a couple. He has a different style in terms of spending money compared to the missus. Dean, talk to me.
Oh, my goodness. Part of the issue is I'm originally from Jamaica, born and raised. The situation under which I grew up, it's just different culture from here. We weren't poor, but we weren't rich, so we still had to kind of not struggle, but we had to work really hard for everything that we were able to get. So I became conscious and aware of money, and we had to make do with what we had and to try to save as much as possible. So coming here, you know, meeting my wife and marrying her, she has a different approach. If she sees something that she really likes, she wants to get it right away. Sometimes she buys things just because it's a good deal, not necessarily because she needs it, but if she sees a good deal, she figures she has to have it. So we always have to talk about that and figure out how can we really try to prioritize where we're going to spend our money and when to spend money.
Now, I have to ask you, what does she say when let's say, she says sees something and she says, okay, I've got to have that. What is the why? Do you say why, or... what does she say to justify it?
You know, to be quite honest, Carmen, I've actually stopped asking why, because it doesn't
really seem... Dean, we've gotten to that point.
We've gotten to that point. You know, I guess I've kind of gotten used to it. I don't think the long-term goals that we're trying to achieve or what we'd like to do later on really play at that point.
Well, Dean, you bring up a really important word. You say goals and thinking about these long-term goals. Do you both sit and talk about these goals regularly, or was it something that's kind of set and you take care of it? How does that work?
We probably don't talk about our goals as much as we need to. We haven't really sat down and spent time talking about what we'd like to achieve and trying to come up with a kind of a plan. You don't really have that much to make a plan with, so you just kind of go day by day and see what happens. And if you get a little windfall, you try to put it away.
Do you guys keep your finances separate, or do you merge everything?
We keep them separate, but we intended to start a joint account this year. We had a joint account earlier, and then we stopped. I don't remember exactly why we stopped. She kept the account, and I just didn't put anything more in it because I still had mine.
Mm-hmm.
But we have talked about actually starting up another joint account later on this year.
So do you pay the bills and like split things between the two of you and you each have your own responsibilities? How do the household bills get paid?
Yes, we split up the bills.
Okay.
She takes care of like the utility. I take care of the mortgage. I take care of some of the credit card payment and medical stuff like that. I take care of, and she takes care of groceries. And then we split stuff as needed for our son, who's 13.
Okay. So, Dean, I'm a huge advocate, actually, for grown-ups being grown-ups and people being able to have their own money. But when it comes to working together as a team, maybe it's a very good idea for the two of you to have a joint account where you pay not only the household bills out of, but that you have an account for the two of you that goes towards your goals. Or that you set very defined limits or goals for your goals. So, for example, it's easy for all of us to say, I want to be able to take a vacation this year. Well, it's hard to save and not spend your money because you don't have a number in your head. If your long-term goals have more of a number tied to them, so let's say you guys want to save for retirement, for an emergency fund, you can say, we need blank amount of money to put in every month in order to get this size emergency fund. Do you think that would be helpful for you?
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, that's helpful.
Well, and I tell you this, Dean, with a lot of experience about dealing with different cultures and their attitudes and approach towards money, and one of the things that kind of brings us all together, very kumbaya, is to really articulate the goals so that they're not kind of like phantoms, They're actually real. And to sit down, and this is the time when, as much as I talk about money in terms of, you know, values and ideas and all spending, but it's a lot about sometimes just sitting down with numbers and saying, first saying, okay, goal number one, to have an emergency fund. How much do we need? How much could we save every month to get to that? Do we want to take a vacation? Do we want to save for retirement? How about your son's college? So once you start actually writing those things down and then plugging some numbers in, the next time that she wants to buy something that maybe she doesn't need, she may say, wow, that $50 should go toward retirement or toward our emergency fund instead. It's kind of just like replacing one with the other, but making it feel important for her to be on the same page.
Like I said, you know, since she has her own finances, you know, it's hard for me to say to her, don't do that, you know, because that's her money. She earned her money. So if she feels like she wants to spend it, she's going to spend it.
Right.
All I do is suggest to her that you may want to think about doing this instead. Part of the other process to that, Carmen, is even with both of us working or earning, once we've paid our bills and taking care of our son, whatever he needs, sometimes there's very little bit left.
Well, and so, and to that point, Dean, it's kind of like, I absolutely respect you as a man who's saying, I am not going to tell my hardworking earning woman what to do with her money. But to that respect, as a couple, are there goals that you have together? So for example, the fact that you're living paycheck to paycheck, there's a lot of danger in that situation, whether, God forbid, you or she ends up losing income, one of you will have to float the other, yes? So in those times of distress, we really find out that when you're a couple, there's very little bit of my money's my money and your money's more your money. It's very much of my money's going to keep us together. It's becomes much more our money. So there's something to thinking as a team. Yes, we each earn money, but these are the things that we have together. We have a household budget together, and we have this goal of not wanting to live paycheck to paycheck because it really affects the both of you. So maybe that's something that you can join together on. So it's not like you're telling her this is what you need to do with your money. It's we need an emergency fund. How much can we put aside, both of us, from our own money each month to build this emergency fund together in case anything happens?
That sounds good. I'm going to try that tonight, actually.
Listen, Dean, I highly recommend maybe a glass of wine, just one, or a beer. But make sure to let me know how that goes, because I think there's a lot to being able to make and have your own money. And I know that that's something that I value very much myself as well. But when you're a couple, to really come together on some issues, because you will help each other.
That's true. That's true.
Thank you, Dean, so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen. I enjoyed it.
And we enjoy hearing from you, so make sure to tweet us at Live Money and leave a voicemail or write at marketplacemoney.org. Click on Ask Carmen.
My name is Chiquita Carter, and I'm a program assistant for the federal government. One of my goals for next year is to not charge anything on credit cards. At the current time, I'm in a little financial debt, even though my credit cards are being paid on time. So I plan to put the credit cards away, pay down on all of them conscientiously until I am credit card debt free, which should take about 18 months. As of December the 1st, I started writing down everything that I spend money on a daily basis, and thus far, I have spent $2.65 in the last 2 days.
Viva Chiquita! Is 2014 going to be different for you and your money? We want to hear how and help where we can. So send me your financial New Year's resolutions at marketplacemoney.org. Tell us your goals and how we can help you succeed. We'd love to hear from you. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, making that list and checking it twice, sticking to your holiday budget. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember to always check with your financial pro before you make any of these big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.